welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about another police shooting of a black person for no reason, Navy SEALs with cash, and Sarkozy's fear of the burkini. But before we can move on, the annals of totally absurd shootings by the police in the United States now has another chapter. On Tuesday, August 23rd, Indianapolis police shot 48-year-old Carl Williams after he called them to his house after his wife was the victim of a crime. It all began at 4:30 a.m. that morning when Williams' wife was held up at gunpoint outside their house and robbed of her car keys. The assailant then drove off in the car. Williams then calls 911 and explains what happened and also describes the person who robbed his wife and noted he had a, quote, long gun. In the background, you can hear Williams' wife explaining what happened and he's also trying to comfort her. You then hear Williams say, "Is that him?" before the call goes dead. This was roughly when the police arrived, and it seems possible that Williams thought the robber was returning, especially because the police took a tactical stance and approached with outlights and sirens and, for the record, with guns drawn. Williams, who is a legal gun owner, wanted to protect his wife. He gets his gun and he goes to the garage. He opens the garage door and almost immediately the police shoot him. His niece stated there was no warning or anything. Williams was shot in the stomach and thankfully should survive. The entire thing, though, is completely absurd. I mean, the police clearly had the drop on whoever was coming out of the garage. Why there was no warning or something, I don't know. But this really reinforces the point we've made before on this show that the attitude of the police nationwide is to shoot first and ask questions later. Further, the officers themselves admit that they had already taken cover, so theoretically they were not even terribly exposed to fire, much less so than whoever was going to come out of that garage. And here is yet another example that the police in America have a shooting and murdering for no reason problem. Matt Bissonnette, the Navy SEAL who wrote a book about his role in the Bin Laden raid without clearing it first with the military, now has to give all the profits back. Bissonnette, when he wrote the book, flaunted the rules set up by the Department of Defense and other agencies dealing with a lot of classified material that requires any books or movies or the like to be cleared with them to make sure nothing classified gets out. Bissonnette's book, written under the pseudonym Mark Owen, called, quote, No Easy Day, was a fairly significant book and has already made just over $6 million that he will now have to give back over the next 4 years. However, to ease the pain, Bissonnette has written another book that did go through the proper channels, which undoubtedly will make a decent amount of money as well. I mean, the whole thing is just absurd on so many levels, but especially in light of Chelsea Manning languishing in prison. I mean, it just makes you wonder if Manning, instead of giving her information to WikiLeaks, had just written a book, maybe she would have also been given a similar slap on the wrist. I mean, this guy can write a whole book that potentially revealed classified information and face no actual punishment beyond just giving the money back. The Obama administration clearly leaked tons of classified information to Catherine Bigelow to make Zero Dark 30. It didn't face anything worse than a couple days of bad press when it came out. Reality is that it's okay to leak classified info as long as you basically stay on side. If your book glorifies special ops or you're helping make a movie that makes torture look necessary, it's all good. If you expose the crimes of empire, you must be punished. It also, of course, is a reminder that justice in America, however it is meted out, is quite capricious. Chelsea Manning, for instance, sentenced in a military trial where even though the charges actually could have been completely dropped, was instead given an extraordinarily political sentence. In the case of Matt Bissonnette, this Navy SEAL, you have a civilian court helping shepherd through an extraordinarily political decision by the Department of Defense to give him a slap on the wrist. Killer cops, perpetrators of sexual assault, we could go on and on. The American justice system isn't actually about justice. It's about creating a semblance of order and stability for the elites. And unfortunately, Nicolas Sarkozy is back in headlines again. The former French president, who has now announced his new bid for the presidency, is ramping up the Islamophobia to make inroads on the right and fend off Marine Le Pen in the battle for the hearts and minds of French people who hate Muslims. And Sarkozy now has become the champion of peeping Toms and leering old men everywhere, aggressively attacking modest swimwear. Sarkozy has come out and claimed that the so-called burkini is a, quote, provocation, and that he won't allow French women to be, quote, imprisoned by fabric. Burkini is a form of bathing suit created by a woman in Australia, designed principally for Muslim women who like to swim, but for whom much of the swimwear sold in Western countries is revealing enough to violate their cultural norms. So in other words, it's just one type of bathing suit of many that people are freely buying and wearing to conform with their religious, cultural values, fashion choices, or whatever that they have chosen. Last time I checked, Sarkozy, proud Christian, isn't trying to ban Catholic school uniforms. The whole thing is just being made into an issue by people who do not like Muslims, period. They're trying to make some absurd connection between the burkini and quote-unquote radical Islam, which one look at any of these beach shots of people in burkinis make clear is a completely absurd. There is not some sort of slow homogenization of swimsuits happening, and most people are still wearing the typical styles that you see on Western beaches. But that's the strategy of people like Sarkozy. Make anything that Muslims do that non-Muslims don't do seem like some sort of secret strategy to turn the entire world Muslim. They use cultural differences to drive wedges between people and do everything but promote understanding between various beliefs and value systems. The world's at a unique moment, clearly in the throes of major change. However, the racists and the Islamophobes and all the other haters are trying to take advantage of the turmoil to promote their hateful neoliberal agendas. This we can't allow. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are really happy to be joined for this conversation by Noah Chenga with The Way with a Noah, which you should definitely check out. Another fantastic radio program that is out there covering a lot of similar issues. And Noah, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
No, of course, of course. So I wanted to start with this. Wednesday, August 24th, was the launch of the Bernie Sanders successor organization, Our Revolution. And I know that you were in the thick of it in the Sanders campaign. So, I mean, I wonder from your perspective, I mean, how much of the energy around the Sanders campaign do you think is realistically really going to translate into this organization? I mean, it sort of seems to me it's maybe more likely that folks are just going to be doing more independent organizing and we'll see the energy manifest itself in a bunch of different ways and that this won't be sort of the end all be all. But I don't know what you think.
Well, I'll just say I was a grassroots volunteer. I did digital organizing with African Americans for Bernie. And then we formed an offshoot group, the Black Burner Coalition as well. So getting to know and interacting with folks from, you know, People's Revolution, which held the People's Convention ahead of the actual Democratic Convention, talking with folks like David Codd from Move to Amend and the Green Party, like just getting to know a whole host of people through this whole process that was, you know, trying to get Bernie Sanders elected in the primary, met so many people who were active, engaged, involved across issues, across movements, that I really think that it, like you were just saying, it's been individuals and various groups that create this synergy of energy and activism and outreach and engagement that culminated in getting behind this candidate, right, in this reform movement. However, as, you know, things went the way they did going into the convention, and I think from talking to friends who delegates, you know, people who were there on the inside, but also talking to friends who were people protesting on the outside, I think a lot of folks felt let down by or felt like they weren't even defended or stood up for. They felt very disrespected. So I really think that while there will be energy behind this new endeavor, I think a lot of people recognizing the agency and power they have as individuals, you don't need to have a fancy title to be the next leader of a movement. You don't need to have a fancy title to go down to City Hall and take process and will take place in the processes that are affecting your individual life. I think a lot of people became empowered in this process, and they're sticking together and will pull through no matter what.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the other issues that's been a little controversial about the way this thing is launched is this whole, I don't actually know if this is real or a rumor, but the idea that the Our Revolution as a 501c4 is going to take money from liberal billionaires and that that's either A, unethical, or B, just against the spirit of what the campaign stood for. I don't know what you thought about that.
So I don't really understand. So I saw that there was conversation about two things. The 501c4 status itself And then, like you were saying, the potential for dark money to then be used to help fund, you know, whether it's good, noble, gold, whatever. You know, Bernie Sanders ran a campaign, you know, basically lambasting the millionaires and the billionaires that pour their money, influence the system. And to see an allegation that Jeff Weaver would be soliciting funds from none other than George Soros, who, you know, was for many people during the campaign, allegations of Soros possibly funding people to sabotage, you know, events and things like that. You know, I think that causes a lot of concern for people when we talk about, you know, really the moral fiber of what is viewed as, you know, this movement. The 501c4 part itself, I caution people from getting all really worked up and excited about, because 501c4 as a tax designation is a common, you know, organizing mechanism for political organizations that are working as nonprofits.
Right.
You know, are there issues and stuff in there? Yes. And should we, you know, look at those? Of course, but I wouldn't just jump automatically because of the designation itself. As a 501c3, they would not be able to do certain things. They would not be able to advocate for specific candidates. I mean, you know, the political activity if you're a C3 is very limited. You know, C4, that's part of what you can do. So that part, I think that I've seen people, like, just on social media, like, oh my God, it's a 501c4. But I do understand the concern about dark money and potentially, you know, having even leadership that's not necessarily completely in line with the grassroots side of thing. The one thing I remind everybody is that the strength, the power, and the success thus far over the last 15 months has been because of grassroots energy and effort. You know, like, yes, Bernie Sanders is a great person. He's, you know, we like what he says, but he would never have gotten this far had it not been for everyday average people leveraging their muscle, their voice to make this what it is.
No, for sure. And I think that was sort of the thrust of a lot of what he was saying, that's not about me. Yeah. It's about us. And I think that's certainly a good point for anyone to remember in progressive social change. You know, the other big issue that was out there was some people felt at the launch that it appeared that the leadership of the group was sort of skewed too heavily white, male, a little bit older. And some people felt that was a bad sign. I've seen some people say, well, I mean, yeah, that's the way it broke down. But if you look at the candidates they're supporting, a lot of people of color on there. So I don't know. I don't know just how you interacted with that issue, if you thought it was an issue or if it was just sort of one of those things that now is becoming controversial.
Well, I think it was, I mean, this was obviously an issue during the campaign as well. Because it became increasingly apparent that, mm-hmm. you know, when people, particularly, I don't know, my dad and I have talked about this. My dad was a big Bernie person, but that's actually the reason why I even became Team Bernie, because I was going to sit it out or pursue, you know, see what other options there were. But I think my dad and I talked about this. We talked about, you know, with age. He's like, you know, he's from Brooklyn. Oh, he's like, my dad remembers just having conversations with his father, another old man from Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, old men, Brooklyn, you know, people are stuck in their ways. They know who they know. They trust who they trust. And that's how they roll. And that's great. That's fine. But when you're talking about leading an organization to create racial, social, economic change, and you do not have a diversity of voices amongst your core, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're only going to repeat, because even when you look at the way Bernie Sanders first started, right, it wasn't until he got pushed back by certain groups that he even began to realize that he needed to talk race economics differently. You know, you don't understand how to process or explore different issues and options if you have people who look and talk and act and think just like you around you. And sure, there's diversity. Not saying that race itself is, you know, a diversity of ideas, because we know many examples where that's not true either. But the fact that there are, out of this entire movement that it has developed, out of all these brilliant, wonderful people who have worked so hard all across the country, that you can't find a way to diversify the board, that you can't find a way to reach out and pull from those voices across all these different issues
right.
and platforms that we're supposed to be addressing. So it's great that we have candidates of color that are being supported. That's wonderful. But we've also seen issues in terms of being able to reach out to communities of color, which are more often than not represented by candidates of color. So how effective can this organization entity be when you haven't even taken stock and addressed serious flaws internally, you know, from the campaign cycle that are now, you know, if you're repeating the same leadership structure, the same some of the same people that were problematic before, you haven't done anything to really address or account for that, you're going to unfortunately repeat some of those same mistakes. And that's not me being negative or a hater or bashing. That's being observant and real about what has happened, because we want to be successful. I want Bernie Sanders, you know, our revolution to be Mm-hmm. I want the other endeavors that you and I are interested, are involved in, the other parties, the other groups that are out there. I want us to be successful and rise up against the tyranny that is in the United States. However, we're not going to do that by repeating the same mistakes, by just digging in our heels and saying, well, these are my people. This is who I roll with. This is what I'm doing no matter what.
No, I hear you.
You can't effectively lead that way.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. And I think we're looking at an interesting moment just to slightly shift gears in the last minute and a half or so that we have here. I mean, it seems like in addition to this, there's such a conspiracy of silence to me in the media about the existence of black progressive voices. I mean, black people yes. seem to be really represented by the most narrow set of political views, more than any other community in the country. And I don't know how that strikes you.
Absolutely agree. And I don't know if that's to some extent the way, you know, when I say we, those of us who rose up between certain ranks or maybe positioned ourselves in a certain way to get in certain positions and become certain voices have done things or the reluctance. I think back when Melissa Harris Perry was booted from MSNBC and she reflects on the people who had been booted before her that she did not vocally support when they were booted. And now she had an understanding when she herself was let go. And I feel like to some extent that maybe with other groupings, people maybe have, I don't know if they collectively leverage better. I don't know what it is, but we do need to find more support for actual, you know, like you said, black progressive voices to have that position on a national stage for people to hear and listen and understand our perspective, because we are represented by people who say things like, well, economics isn't a black issue, and then turn right around when they get their candidate in. It's like, well, we got to talk about jobs for black people. Well, you just said 2 months ago that this wasn't important. You just said that we're not poor, that we don't struggle, but, you know, it's problematic, and it keeps us in a certain position, you know, in our communities where we're not able to really organize effectively because we have these certain, you know, hand chosen right. leaders or voices, and we have to do something different.
Which is why I hear you.
Stay independent and be- So
of course.
You.
No, of course. And we're going to have to leave it there. But that was Anoa Chenga. And listen to The Way with Anoa, which another excellent, fantastic, progressive podcast. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about climate change and its relationship to social movements. And we are happy to be joined to continue this conversation by Christian Parenti, who is an author and political commentator. So I just wanted to start our conversation here with the continued tragedy taking place in Louisiana, the most recent flooding, and really just before that, weeks of unrest over the issues with policing, the Alton Sterling case, and how the two could potentially be connected. I mean, this is something that I know you talk a lot about, which is the connection between climate change catastrophes and a lot of the social dynamics happening, you know, around the world, but in this country. So I didn't know, you know, in the way it fell in Baton Rouge, if you were seeing any of those connections here.
Well, there's the connection of, you know, the pattern of extreme weather that all the climate models have predicted playing out. And of course, whenever there's a disaster like this, there's always a controversy. People say, oh, well, you can't blame this on climate change. And in fact, some climate scientists are, you know, increasingly confident about making causal links to climate change. But the point is not whether this or that storm is caused by climate change, but that the patterns fit, the patterns of weather as it is occurring increasingly fits the pattern that has been predicted by the 14 major global climate models that predict increased flooding, increased drought, more extreme storms, rising sea levels, and all that is playing out. We now have over 30 years of observations to compare to the predictions of 30 years ago. And, you know, the models are unfortunately more or less correct. So whether or not we're going to say Baton Rouge is caused by, well, it certainly fits the pattern of climate change. It fits the pattern of more extreme weather due to a hotter atmosphere and hotter seas.
No, absolutely. I think obviously that's certainly the case. I think there's almost been something like 9 extreme weather events this year. I mean, it's obviously, you know, unbelievable when we had the fire situation out in California right around the same time. And it just raises it. And, you know, one
fire season is supposed to be 78 days longer than it was in 1970, meaning the conditions of, you know, dryness, et cetera, lightning, or 78 days more of that a year in California than in 1970. So,
no, I hear you. And it also, and honestly, the other sort of thing that it speaks to, not only the fire season being longer, but is just sort of the unbelievable reality of the real estate industry, right? I mean, they're obviously trying to make money, not put people in homes. So, I mean, they'll build anywhere, everywhere, right up to, you know, the most dangerous areas. And you put yourself in a situation where sort of the existence of these climate emergencies is so heavily colliding with the profit motive. I mean, that seems like certainly a good example of that out there in California, for sure. I don't know how, you know, that strikes you.
Yeah, I mean, there's the patterns of development you describe, increased vulnerability. Also, the, you know, there's still the legacy of the bad kind of forest management of fire suppression and being opposed to control burns. And you know, there was a long generations of forestry was in denial about the central role of fire, particularly out west, but also, you know, in the east. Not that forest fires are a problem in the east, but Native Americans in the eastern U.S. managed forests with controlled burns in the winter. So that's another aspect of it. And I think the larger point is this idea that climate change doesn't just produce disasters in isolation from policy, that there's always an interaction with policy and politics. And, you know, the key thing was the one you touched on, of the profit motive, that if planning and forbearance ever come into conflict with money making, you know that money making is generally in this country and very often around the world going to win. And so what we have is, you know, a political culture that's totally opposed to any kind of long-term planning, and that's setting us up for major problems. That may be changing a little bit, though. You know, I mean, there's this Portland, Oregon has been preparing for a huge earthquake, and they realize that first responders can't handle all of the needs in the face of a massive disaster. That's a positive thing, like the idea of training the population to help each other, because that is in fact what happens during disasters, right? We've seen that down in Baton Rouge. We see that in New Orleans and Katrina. You know, most people who are extracted from some flooded building are extracted by their neighbors and volunteers, because there simply aren't enough first responders. But if we were serious about climate change, we would be getting off fossil fuels as fast as possible, building out renewable energy. We would shift all the subsidies away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And there would also be an acceptance of the fact that we are locked in for major changes, that even in the best case scenario, if there was no more fossil fuels burnt from tomorrow on, we would still be looking at a climate that would become increasingly chaotic. We're locked in for sea level rises, you know, minimum 3 feet, probably more by the end of the century. And all of that should be central to planning at every level of government and for all institutions. The civilization as a whole should be increasingly concerned with solidarity and preparation for the kinds of shocks and disasters that are baked in already.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's a good point. I mean, it raises another issue in my mind, too, just in the terms of the way that it's presented to people. I mean, I think on the one hand, obviously, there's a rising consciousness around climate change related issues. There's certainly some obstructionist, but a rising consciousness. But on the other hand, I think the way it's often presented to people, sometimes often by members of the quote unquote environmental movement, is that, well, we can only move but so fast because especially technology hasn't really caught up, or we don't have the things we need to really make renewable energy work at the scale it would need to. And thus sort of, you know, there's only but so much we can do. And I wonder how you sort of respond to that. I guess, I don't know if it's a critique, that point that people often make.
Yeah, I mean, sure, there's only so much we can do, but we're not there yet. We're not like pushing up against the limits by any means of what we can do. So the key things to remember are, you know, we have the technology, right? It's not like we haven't invented commercial scale wind. It's not like we haven't invented commercial scale utility level solar plus distributed solar. It's not like we don't have an electrical grid. It's not like there aren't electric vehicles that could be plugged into that grid. all the technology is there. We also have the money. The federal government is a major consumer of energy. It should shift its energy consumption immediately to all renewables, and then that would help spur investment in the private sector. There's, you know, the question of the military budget being shifted, et cetera, et cetera. But just like dealing with the fact that the federal government is a major consumer of vehicles and energy, and that government consumption is actually a huge part of what brings technology to scale, typically in the form of government procurement for the military. But not only that, I mean, modern computing is very much a result not just of government investment in R&D, but also government indirect subsidy of particularly IBM in the 50s and 60s by purchasing the products of the computer sector, which in the beginning really was just IBM. And for like the first almost two decades of IBM's existence, more than half of its sales were to government. And that helps build economies of scale for these firms and industries. So the government does that with fossil fuels. It did that with aviation. It's done that with motor vehicles. And it needs to do that with renewable energies and clean technologies around transportation, et cetera, by being not only a subsidizer of the R&D and a subsidizer of the production, but an active and leading consumer of these technologies, because that will help achieve economies of scale. It's as simple as if you interviewed the CEO of a company, the only company in America that makes electric trucks, assembles them. And he said that if he could buy components in batches of 100 rather than batches of 5 and 10, in some cases he could lower the cost of the overall vehicle by 25 to 30%, which would make it competitive, make these trucks competitive with gasoline and diesel trucks. And for many, for example, like delivery services, that would mean that it would make more sense to, if you're not doing long-haul trucking, right, if you're just distributing beer and soda in the same city every day, it would make economic sense to buy electric trucks that you plug in every night at the garage and recharge them if they're the same price as gasoline vehicles, because electricity is generally at this point, competitive with fossil fuels. So the government can help push that by being a consumer. For example, the post office has 140,000 vehicles, most of which just park in the same place every night, drive 18 miles a day. There's no reason they shouldn't all be electric. The post office is going to continue to buy vehicles. They should shift to electric vehicles and help that sector build out. But then there's also the question of the private sector and its money. And, you know, part of the problem of the world economy right now is overaccumulation, to put it in Marxist terms. There is actually too much cash in the hands of investors and not enough places for it to be invested profitably. And so that's part of what leads to speculative bubbles. You bid up the price of assets like housing or tech stocks. And really what corporate America needs is exactly what it resists most, which is a threat to that hoarding that will cause them to invest. Corporate America is sitting on more uninvested cash than at any time since the Federal Reserve has been measuring this, which goes back to the early 50s. It's over $2 trillion. And this is money that firms park in low-yield, safe government securities, and they're kind of waiting for what the next big thing is to invest in. If government gave the cues that, you know, the fossil fuel sector is being written off and closed down, and there is going to be a massive build out of renewable energy, when we ask, well, where would the money come from to build all these solar farms? Where would the money come from to upgrade the grid, et cetera, et cetera? Well, a lot of it would come from the private sector, which is currently just sitting on it waiting for the next big thing. And if they saw, oh, wow, this is really what's happening, you got to build wind farms. You got to build out distributed solar, et cetera, et cetera. There would be enormous amounts of private investment that would flow into spaces if those spaces were designated through government policy and government procurement as real growth areas. So the good news is, you know, we've got these two components. We've got money, we've got the technology. The other thing is we actually, in many ways, already have the laws to get rid of the fossil fuel industry. And that is, they're not the perfect laws, but they exist. And we're not going to probably get new comprehensive climate legislation through any government in the U.S. in the foreseeable future. But this is the Clean Air Act of 1970 that was modified by a lawsuit, Massachusetts versus EPA, which was filed in 1997 by Massachusetts and several other states and several green groups. They sued the EPA when the U.S. failed to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. They said the EPA has an obligation to regulate greenhouse gases because, according to the language of the Clean Air Act, these are dangerous to human beings. It took them 10 years. They won. And in 2007, the Supreme Court said, yes, the EPA has the obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So Bush did nothing. Obama drags his feet. Now, finally, he's beginning to allow the EPA to develop policy to comply with the Clean Air Act in that regard. So if we supported and protected the EPA and there were a president who would defend it and let it do what it has to do by law, which is to say, put caps on emissions, what that would do is it would drive up the cost of dirty energy. So, you know, the EPA doesn't have the power to say you cannot burn coal. It just says if you burn coal and your emissions are above X, you pay this amount of fine. And what that does is it basically puts a tax on carbon emissions that raises the price of dirty energy, which then makes clean energy all the more competitive. And clean energy prices, particularly solar, have been dropping precipitously, even in this, the midst of this fracking revolution, where there's now just way too much oil, way too much gas in global markets. The price of fossil fuels have really plummeted. Coal is being totally wiped out. And you'd think, oh, well, that's the end for expensive renewable energy. In fact, solar energy has been keeping up in terms of the price point per kilowatt hour, which is really incredible. So if there was just a little more government pressure on fossil fuels, we'd see those prices go up relative to renewables. So what I'm saying is, like, all the pieces are really kind of already in place, and we're kind of already going in the right direction, but just at an totally pathetically slow rate.
Right. Well, and isn't that to some degree the nature of the critique that I think is being raised now by, you know, to some degree, Naomi Klein, people who call themselves eco-socialists, is, you know, sort of all the pieces are there. But the reality is that the role of capitalist class power in the economy, the point you were making, the difference between what you need and what you resist, it makes it impossible for that the pieces to converge in the right way in enough time, which is why there has to be an explicitly anti-capitalist movement.
It is, you know, the main hurdle that we have to overcome. And, you know, the thing is, capitalists need the state to organize them and to reproduce the society. Capital, the drive to turn labor and non-human nature into money, that, you know, that force as a dynamic, a virus, a sort of social virus within a society does not have the ability to organize itself. And if you look at the history of capitalism from its earliest origins in mercantilism in the 16th century, you realize, well, you know, what's been central to the development and the continual maintenance of this system globally is always state power to contain and rein in the capitalist class, to save them from themselves. That is the essential thing that the state must do. And that's the heart of what reformist politics are. It's like using state power to contain capital, using state power to save the capitalist class from itself. And when the state is totally captured by the capitalist class, then it fails to do that. And the ultimate result is almost inevitably state failure and social breakdown.
Yeah, no, I think that certainly is fair enough to say. And I mean, I think that ultimately, you know, that's sort of, perhaps it increases the imperative of other social movements. I mean, how much do you think climate justice should become an umbrella for sort of the broad range of insurgent movements that we see now that are all sort of in some ways questioning the state power?
Well, yeah, it should be part of all these things. I mean, I'd like to, you know, before that, at least just see social movements pay more and more serious attention to the state and what is it? What are its contradictions? We criticize the state in the form of the police, and rightly so, for being racist and brutal. But if our critique of what state power is stops there, we're missing a large part of what the state can do. And of course, what is socialist revolution? If there's going to be a socialist transformation, that's about using, you know, having social movements that can build organizational and institutionalized capacity strong enough to force the state to euthanize capital and to socialize the means of production. Short of that, social democracy, robust reformist politics involves very much the same dynamic. People organizing in movements that oppose the state, but also realize that the state is a toolbox with which they can institutionalize their power and control business, control the profit motive, control capital, mm-hmm. and control and contain and ultimately, hopefully, you know, more or less mm-hmm. euthanize the capitalist class, not necessarily as individuals, but
as a class itself,
as a class sure. that has the final say on how the society is to be organized and governed.
And run. And we're going to be back with more with Christian Parenti. This is By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about climate change and its relationship to social movements, and we are happy to be joined to continue this conversation by Christian Parenti, who is an author and political commentator. So, you know, shifting to a slightly more global perspective, I think one of the things that's interesting that I've seen people sort of talk about, and I know this is something that you've studied, is sort of the role of different climate aspects as sort of a catalytic factor. So, for example, the role of, say, a drought and increasing food prices or whatever in the basic food basket, and then that driving people's anger and not having enough to eat because they don't have good jobs because there's austerity and so on and so forth. And then you get explosions like the Arab Spring. So, I mean, I wonder if you could also speak to this issue of climate change as almost sort of a catalytic factor in other issues that we view sort of in isolation, but in reality, there's sort of a chain there.
Well, I mean, in my book, I dealt with the role of climate change and free market economics interacting to create violence around the world, both in the global South and North. But so the example you gave is a prominent one of the food price shocks. The second food price shock in about 5 years is part of what triggers the Arab Spring. That's caused not by the drought in the Middle East, which there is a drought in the Middle East. That's part of what kicks off the Syrian war. But rather droughts and flooding in the main grain growing regions of the world. And particularly in Russia, 2010, 11, there were major droughts that helped drive up grain prices, which then translated through global markets as increasing food prices in the Middle East, particularly in the Maghreb and Tunisia and then Egypt. And so, in asking oneself, why did people put up with this brutal Mahabharat kleptocratic state for as long as they did? Why didn't they wait another 5 years? Why didn't they rebel 10 years earlier? And part of the answer lies in the fact that there was this second food price shock that helped trigger it. And when the Arab Spring jumped off, one of the things that people were chanting for as President Ben Ali fled in Tunisia was for lower food prices. But there's a way also that, and I would not want to romanticize what climate change might do for the left, but there are other examples, which I didn't actually put in the book, because I don't know why, I think I spaced out on it. But it occurred to me when someone asked me a question, have you ever seen like natural disasters help sort of catalyze progressive movements? And I did once in 2011 in Pakistan, went there for the Nation and reported on the floods. And I remember interviewing poor peasants, the Hari, who had been displaced by the floods and were living outside of cities and in tent cities. And I remember saying, oh, well, you guys must be really desperate to go home, et cetera. And they were like, no, we don't want to go home. Like, do you know what home was? It was like, we were the serfs of these landlords who illegally made us responsible for our parents' debts in violation of Pakistani law, who used the village school as a stable for their cattle. No, we don't want to go back. And in fact, like landlords would send thugs to these refugee camps to try and extract people who owed them debts, and people would band together and push back and, you know, push these guys out. And they had started these just sort of survival level social movements about dealing with sanitation and support in the camps and then defending their right to stay there, you know. And they were like, hey, if we live here in the city, we can get, you know, at least day labor. There are schools here. Our kids can at least go to school a little bit. Back in the countryside, you know, we were under the yoke of these thugs. And it really was a semi-feudal, it's feudalism with electricity and gasoline and guns instead of swords and torchlight in many parts of Pakistan. And so these peasants, the Hadi, were kind of liberated from this totally oppressive system that they were encased in by the floods. So I wouldn't want to say, oh, yes, you know, rising sea levels, right, all these things are like, you know, shake the foundations of these oppressive hierarchies and liberate the, you know, the capacities of people to self-organize. But there's definitely that possibility. Mm-hmm. And we saw a lot of collective action in New Orleans after Katrina. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of kind of like similar kind of grassroots, just by necessity, solidarity going on in Baton Rouge, where people who have lived in isolation from each other, you don't know who your neighbors are, then suddenly it's like, you know, your neighbors help save your life. And it's like there's a new kind of solidarity among people that comes out of that. So that's something that I think is not like positive, it's not good news, but that's if you asked about the kind of political catalytic effects of climate change, not necessarily all catalyzing despotism and ethnic hatred and religious fanaticism. I think it can, in fact, like catalyze new forms of solidarity, rekindle old solidarities.
Well, I certainly think those are all very good points, very interesting points. And I wonder in some ways how they collide with one element of our current moment, which is the election, which is the presidential election here in the United States, the Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump contest. I mean, you know, you've got the Cold War mentality on the one hand with Clinton. You've got Trump, who's got the just uber imperialist attitude. I mean, it sort of seems like the challenges are so big, and certainly the as are the solutions, although they're certainly comprehensible, but that we don't, there's no one sort of in play that's about to have their hands on the lever of power that can do anything but make the situation somewhat worse. I mean, it appears it's just a matter of degree, but I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, it's a profoundly depressing election, and it looks like Hillary Clinton is going to be elected, and she is she's a corporate neoliberal Democrat who is also very clearly a self-dealer. You know, I mean, yesterday Judicial Watch just released yet more emails, and you know, it's like some prince from Qatar, Bahrain, I forget where, you know, basically made a $32 million donation to the Clinton Global Initiative in exchange for a meeting with Hillary Clinton facilitated in less than 48 hours by Uma Abedin. So, you know, that's where she's coming from. And we know what her husband's policies were, and we know her role in botching healthcare and supporting welfare reform. And it's been well documented in the mainstream media, her role in the Obama administration as a powerful, hardcore military hawk. She was a deciding vote on pushing for aid to the Syrian rebels, quote unquote, moderate rebels. What a total joke that concept is. And it's also been documented very thoroughly in the mainstream media that, you know, the vast majority of the support channeled through the CIA to those quote unquote moderate weapons ended up with al-Nusra and other fanatics, and that some units that were supplied by the US indirectly even went over to Islamic State. So, you know, she was pushing for that. She was the deciding vote in many ways on Libya. You know, Obama was very much on the fence about that. He's already said that was his greatest regret of his presidency. That was a war that was started by the French. Go back and, you know, read the newspaper history on this. It's like that was Sarkozy. He started that. And it was about France within NATO, within Europe, kind of like throwing its weight around. And there were warnings from the U.S. that said, like, hey, don't expect us to come finish this one for you. But that's exactly what the U.S. did when the French and the British bombing sorties started running low on ammunition. You know, I mean, you got to remember, even though those are huge militaries, they're nothing compared to the U.S. military. The U.S. military is so enormous. It's like orders of magnitude larger than the next largest allied militaries. And so in that whole question, like, you know, is the U.S. going to let the Europeans like hang out to dry on this one and deal with the problem they've created on their own? Or is the U.S. going to use the opportunity of this war against Gaddafi in Libya to prove to its allies that it is once again the indispensable nation? Well, you know, Joe Biden was like, we got to stay out of it. Don't do this. Don't overthrow Gaddafi. And Hillary Clinton was the deciding vote in the cabinet, who was like, no, we got to do this. And look what happened. It created a horrible failed state. So Hillary Clinton was the deciding vote in the Obama cabinet on helping to create one solidly failed state, Libya, and basically one semi-failed, half-failed state, Syria. So, you know, we can expect, I think, that she's going to be very bellicose on foreign policy and probably drag her feet in terms of an energy transition. And of course, a foreign policy response is, you know, that's a huge part of how climate change is dealt with. You know, that only exacerbates the problems. It's like, if farmers, as was the case in Syria, if farmers are being forced off the land, partly by drought, partly by austerity, because that's what happened in Syria. It was like there was drought and there was also austerity, kind of neoliberal austerity being imposed on the Assad regime, which Assad regime had resisted, but then trying to curry favor with the international community, was increasingly cutting subsidies to the rural poor, many of whom are majority Sunni. The regime is Alawite, which is a breakoff sect from Shia. Those poor Sunni farmers move into the cities. They become lumpen proletariat. They have no skills. They've lost their land. And then this takes on the dynamics of a class, but also sort of religious conflict. That's partly, you know, a climate crisis right there. Well, if the response to that is bomb the regime, destroy the infrastructure, fund ruthless, insane fanatics like al-Nusra, the former al-Qaeda affiliate there, you know, what are you going to get? You're going to get massive refugee flows, right? And thousands of people dying in the Mediterranean, which then in turn creates a hardening of state power and an increases the xenophobic rhetoric of the far right in Europe. So any kind of strategy coming out of the U.S. that were to be realistic about how to deal with the very serious climatological shocks that are built in is going to have to rethink militarism and rethink neoliberalism, this idea that, you know, the public sector must be stripped down to almost nothing, that the market can solve all problems. And we have, you know, far too many decades of evidence from too many continents showing that that is not true, that neoliberalism, even when it increases growth rates, which it frequently does not do, as in the case of Latin America in the 1980s, always increases inequality, always increases instability. And what we need is increased solidarity and increased stability to deal with the major economic and socioeconomic and environmental shocks that will be part of the near future and are already part of the present.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of Hillary Clinton's legacy and then also refugees and migrants, you know, the other big news from last week was the issue of the Obama administration saying that they were going to end all of the private prison contracts and the Bureau of Prison System under the Department of Justice. And there was two elements of it that I thought were interesting. I mean, one, the issue that immigration detention centers, which are almost all private, 70% of prisoners, were exempted. But also, I just wonder, are we overplaying this issue in the sense of, well, I mean, yes, private prisons are bad, but if all we really do is sort of shift from, you know, public to private, it doesn't seem like we really have gotten at the root of mass incarceration.
Yeah. I mean, that was good news last week, you know, ending federal government's use of private prisons. But you're right, it doesn't address the private immigration facilities. 30,000 people a night are in these facilities, and they're almost all run by private companies, unlike in prisons, where private prisons have never really controlled more than 8% of beds at the state and federal level. And that's partly because it's really expensive to run a prison, not just because there's supposed to be some programs of rehabilitation, et cetera. But also when you get into more high-level security, it's just capital intensive and it's labor intensive, and you can't do that on the cheap. CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, a company that was in many ways started by the Reagan administration. This was a firm that was born out of cues coming from the Reagan Justice Department, some initial funding actually from owners of KFC, the Kentucky Fried Chicken. You know, wow. It was like the government really kind of encouraged that. The peak of CCA's dominance was 96. They had it wasn't like a supermax, but it was like a kind of, I think it was a maximum or kind of a medium maximum facility in Youngstown. It was the highest level security prison a private prison company had ever tried to run. And there were like mass escapes, six guys escaped, some guards were stabbed. It was just total chaos. And they realized they can't do this. You can't do that and make money. Not everything can be done profitably. And so then they shift towards low hanging fruit, people who are easier to control and dominate, like, single mothers and their two kids who are just trying to get to America so they can clean hotel rooms. You know, they're easier to control, it turns out, than like, a bunch of like 25-year-old guys who first went into prison at age 15 and are like, totally committed to serious underworld gang wars. Not to pathologize everyone who's in prison, but also let's not be ridiculous. Like, there are serious characters in real prisons, and the idea that you can just like, do this on the cheap and easy, which is what the private prison companies tried to do. I mean, that doesn't work. So so this ruling, this decision from the FOGRM, it's a step in the right direction. And in terms of dealing with mass incarceration and undoing the overuse of incarceration, there are some other positive things that have been happening, right? The legalization of marijuana, de facto legalization, that's very good, because at the heart of this is, in many ways, the war on drugs. And so the more that can be rolled back, the better. And then, there's got to be an unwinding of all of the powers and supports that got us to this. So the power of prosecutors is really important. And this is something that, I don't really write as many articles as I used to, focusing more on books these days, but I would encourage young journalists who cover criminal justice to really dig into the power of prosecutors. They are horrendous. In jurisdiction after jurisdiction, you see that they really play a role in overusing incarceration. So anyway, all of those things have to be addressed. And then I think that cutting back on the federal aid that goes to the police, that goes to prosecutors, is very important, because that's part of what encourages overuse, investigation, arrest, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's going to do it for today's show here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.